طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر، من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is produced by Despina Moutsouris. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning we want to take a look at the changing attitudes concerning the Palestinian-Israeli struggle reflected in various segments of the population. There is much to be pessimistic about concerning this issue, but increasingly we are seeing shifting opinions finding expression throughout our society, and perhaps some data that can give us a bit of an optimistic take on where we are going on this most complex issue. This morning we have Josh Rubner of the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation and Columbia University professor Rashid Khalidi look at some polling information that give us actual data on how attitudes are indeed shifting on the Palestinian issue. This analysis was presented at a conference titled Capitalizing on Changing Sentiment Toward Israeli Aggression, sponsored by American Muslims for Palestine in Chicago, November of 2014. First up is Josh Rubner, Policy Director of the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation.
Good afternoon. Salaam alaikum. Today's session here is entitled Capitalizing on Changing American Sentiment Toward Palestine and Israeli Aggression. So what I'd like to do with the few minutes that I'll be speaking with you is to share with you the results of some recent public opinion polls and to try to tease out what some of the implications are for the topic at hand of how we do capitalize on these changing sentiments. The first public opinion poll that I want to draw your attention to was commissioned by Professor Shibli Telhami and published in Foreign Policy in March of 2014. This was at the height of the frenzy of U.S. efforts to broker a last-ditch two-state, quote-unquote, resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian issue. And in this poll, Professor Telhami looked at the question of what is your preferred resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian issue. At the height of this U.S. brokering of this quote-unquote peace process effort, he found that 39% of Americans supported a two-state resolution to the issue. What I found extremely fascinating about this was that even before the definitive breakdown of the so-called peace process, you still had a quarter of Americans who supported a one-state democratic resolution. And then lesser amounts of people, 14% of Americans, supported Israel annexing the Palestinian West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza Strip without providing citizenship for Palestinians under occupation. And then 10% of Americans believe that Israel should continue to indefinitely occupy Palestinian territories, maintaining the status quo. This was the rough breakdown of public opinion before the definitive conclusion of Kerry's peace efforts this spring. Professor Talhami also asked, if a two-state resolution is not feasible, if these peace process negotiations break down, what then is your preferred solution? And what he found, I think, was incredibly stunning. He found that nearly 2 in 3 Americans supported the notion of Israel / Palestine being transformed into a democracy with equal rights for all of its citizens. 2/3. And less than 1/4 of Americans thought that Israel maintaining itself as a Jewish supremacist and apartheid state in the collapse of the peace process was their preferred resolution. Now that's a lot of people, 1/4 who would support indefinite racism, indefinite colonization and dispossession of the Palestinian people. But I think what's important to draw from this particular public opinion poll is that nearly 2/3 of Americans believe that there should be democracy and equal rights between Palestinians and Israeli Jews in the absence of there being an independent Palestinian state. The second poll that I want to draw your attention to came out at the height of Israel's massacre of Palestinians in Gaza this summer. It was a poll commissioned by CNN, and overall, CNN found that 57% of Americans believed that Israel was justified in its actions and 34% opposed. And from this aggregate result, CNN portrayed this as if people in the United States were solidly supportive of Israel's actions towards Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. But this poll, at least in the aggregate, was incredibly disingenuous, because this is the question that the pollsters actually asked. Was Israel justified in taking action against Hamas? The question was not whether Israel was justified in attacking and injuring and killing Palestinian civilians and demolishing Palestinian civilian infrastructure, as Leila mentioned at the outset. And if the question were worded in that way, I think we would have seen even more dramatic results. But even so, when you look at the aggregate numbers of the CNN poll, they tell a very different story when you start to break these numbers down. Men responded that they thought Israel's actions were justified 64% of the time, and only 30% found that Israel's actions were not justified. Compare these numbers to the response of women. The support for Israel's actions drops to 50%, with almost 40% opposing. Let's look at how this opinion poll affected people by their race. According to the CNN poll, 61% of white people felt Israel's actions were justified, 29% opposed. But when they asked the same question of people of color, it was even. Only 47% were supportive, 44% were opposed. There's also very interesting figures from this poll broken down by age. So, for example, CNN found that the older an American is, the more supportive they were of Israel's actions. So we see the 65 and older crowd supporting Israel by a 3-to-1 margin. And we see a similar pattern for 50 to 64-year-olds. But when you start getting into my age cohort, ages 35 to 49, you begin to see a generational split in how Americans view this issue and Israel's actions toward the Palestinian people, with support for Israel's actions dropping to 53%. And look what happens when we poll the youth in this country. A majority do not support Israel's actions towards Palestinians in Gaza this year. 47% support, 45% oppose. There were also some interesting breakdowns in terms of people's income. People who earned $50,000 or more supported Israel by a margin of 64 to 27. And when we look at people who earn less than $50,000 a year, again, it's almost even, 49% versus 41%. Finally, this is most fascinating of all from this CNN poll. Look at the huge support for Israel within the Republican Party and people who identify as Republicans. A whopping 3 in 4 Americans who identify as Republicans supported Israel's actions. And look what happens when you look at Democrats. Again, a majority of Democrats in the United States did not support Israel's actions, according to CNN. And in fact, it was almost even. So what are some of the implications that we can draw from these two public opinion polls? First of all, let's recognize that even senior U.S. officials understand that the peace process is dead. The window for there being a two-state resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian issue is over. In the spring of 2013, Secretary of State John Kerry testified to Congress that there exists a 1 to 2 year window of opportunity for establishing a viable and sovereign and independent Palestinian state. This was 18 months ago. So even John Kerry has recognized that this window has closed and that the two-state option is, for all intents and purposes, according to U.S. officials, dead. This has implications in terms of how we frame the issues, how we talk about the issues to our fellow Americans. And even though I work for an organization called the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation, I think, especially today, that this framing is wrong. It's not the framing that's going to capture the imagination of the American public and convince them of new possibilities and new paradigms for resolving this issue fairly and justly. But what we saw from the Tilhami poll was that by vast majorities, now that this two-state peace process has definitively collapsed, Americans support the notion of equality and democracy between Palestinians and Israeli Jews. This is something that we can build on in our messaging, something that American Muslims for Palestine has done an excellent job of in terms of its messaging. So keeping in mind these notions of democracy and equality is perhaps new ways to frame this issue. The other implication I think that we can draw from these public opinion polls is that if we are trying to convince older, wealthier, white Republican males, we are barking up the wrong tree. This is not the base where there is sympathy for Palestinians and their cause in the United States. Israel's support base is becoming older, wealthier, white, Republican males. And this is, of course, a shrinking demographic within the United States. And this is a phenomenon that Israel and its supporters in the United States are dreadfully scared of. They understand full well that they cannot rely upon the support of older white male Republicans to sustain this unconditional policy of support for Israel's actions. This is why the Israel lobby is working overtime to try to cultivate youth, cultivate people of color, to become the next generation of pro-Israel advocates in this country. But I think what the CNN poll confirms from a lot of anecdotal evidence that I've seen over the last few years is that there is a huge amount of space, a huge amount of political opportunity for Palestinians and for people who support the Palestinian cause to be educating and organizing people within the Democratic Party, amongst women, amongst the working class, amongst people of color, and most importantly, among youth. These are the communities and the constituencies where we are seeing a fundamental break with previous bipartisan traditions of lockstep support for Israel's action amongst public opinion. So let me just give you a few anecdotes and then I'll wrap up. Some of you may remember the spectacle at the Democratic National Convention in 2012 when the mayor of Los Angeles was presiding over the convention, and he asked for unanimous consent to pass a resolution declaring Jerusalem to be the eternal undivided capital of the state of Israel. And there was an eruption of protest on the floor of the DNC, the Democratic National Convention, not just because he was trying to ram through a substantive issue in this way, but because of the resolution itself. And there was so much opposition, and you can go and watch the video of this on YouTube, there was so much opposition that he actually called for the vote not once, not twice, but three times. And it was clear that there was tremendous opposition on the floor of the convention to this resolution, and he declared that it passed anyway, further inflaming and angering Democratic delegates to the convention. I think this anecdote shows more than anything else that the power base of Israel within the Democratic Party is a strictly top-down affair. It's a strictly top-down affair, and I've been traveling the country a lot this past year, and I've been talking a lot with Democratic Party activists who have been telling me how upset the base is with their party's policies, with the policies of our country. So there's room within the Democratic Party to organize. There's room within labor to organize as never before. After Israel massacred Palestinians in Gaza this year, we've seen many ports in the United States where it has been impossible for Israeli ships to dock and unload their products because they've been boycotted and picketed, and the longshoremen unions have refused to cross the picket lines in solidarity with Palestinians. This is a major development, a major positive development within labor in the United States, and there is room for more organizing. And finally, just let me say one more thing about people of color and youth, and them truly being the future. Because when I go and I speak on college campuses, I'm just amazed at these coalitions that Students for Justice in Palestine have put together to advocate for and to pass divestment resolutions, because they understand the intersectionality of this work. They understand that the cause of justice for the Palestinian people cannot be separated from the cause of other people and other struggles. And they're building these amazing cross-community, cross-identity coalitions that are presenting this rainbow front against Israel's very, very narrow support on campus. And so this is why I'm fundamentally optimistic about where things are heading. Because it's very clear from these public opinion polls that Israel's base of support is eroding, and there are tremendous opportunities for us to be organizing to challenge these policies. Thank you very much.
That was Josh Rubner, policy director for the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation. And the next speaker is Rashid Khalidi, professor of history at Columbia University.
It's a pleasure to be here a second year in a row. It's a pleasure to see a room that's beginning to fill up again. I'm going to pick up exactly where Josh left off, and I'll be saying some of the same things that he said, but I hope with a little bit, with some differences, because what I'm going to try and do is talk about how things have changed so that we can get to the point that Josh has talked about. And I'm going to start by saying that I think that sentiments in the United States, as far as Palestine is concerned, have definitely changed. I was born here very long ago, much longer ago than many of you think. I grew up here, and I lived most of my life here. And I've followed the Palestine issue in the United States at least since the 1960s. And I have to say that I have seen more change in the past 10 years than I've seen in the 50 years before it, more positive change in terms of attitudes towards Palestine. Now, unfortunately, if you look at the surface, it's not clear that things have changed. If you look at three main areas, in fact, it's not clear that things have changed. If you look at the political landscape, if you look at the mainstream media, if you look at the main organizations that purport to represent the Jewish community in this country, it is not at all apparent that there's been any change. The political landscape at the level of Congress, the level of the executive, has not witnessed any significant positive change. I would argue the contrary. Congress is even worse today than it was 30 or 40 years ago. The evidence is the kinds of laws on terrorism which single out Muslims or Arabs or Middle Easterners. But there's much other evidence we know about American policy in Palestine. I don't need to tell that to this audience. The mainstream media, the mainstream corporate media, is still, as we all know, overwhelmingly pro-Israeli. It is still repeating assumptions unfavorable to Palestinians and Arabs and Muslims, and is still repeating ridiculous assumptions favorable to Israel. Self-defense in Gaza, for example. Any positive change in the mainstream corporate media is only coming at the margins. We saw this during the Israeli attack on Gaza this past summer. Finally, the establishment institutions of the Jewish community are still tightly in the great grip of right-wingers. They're monolithic in opposing even limited change. There's an organization called J Street, which tried to get admitted to the Conference of Presidents of major American Jewish organizations. J Street talks about itself as pro-Israel, pro-peace. The Conference of Presidents would not even allow J Street in. And it's as moderate, as Zionist, as mainstream a Jewish organization as is imaginable. So, if you took things at face value, if you assumed that what the politicians and the media and the establishment, major establishment Jewish organizations say, represents reality, then you would think that nothing has changed. But I want to take each of these in turn. I want to take politics, I want to take the media, I want to take the Jewish community, and I want to show you that, in fact, lots of things are going on underneath the surface. And actually, I was going to talk about the poll that Josh just mentioned. The important thing about this is the young people and women and non-whites. That is the future majority of the United States. That is the direction the population of this country is going to be going in 5 or 10 years. Not today. Old white Republican men run this country. Congress is run by old white Republican men. The country is owned by old men. But that is not the future, demographically, of the United States. And Democratic politicians in the Democratic Party, are fully aware of that. Now, there are reasons why, even though that's the trend with the young, that's the trend with women, it's the trend with non-whites, politicians have still not come around to recognizing it. Even or if they know that it's there, they're still not changing their positions. One reason is money. Money is in the hands of old white men. Second is that young people don't vote. I'm talking to you, the young people out here. Old people vote. Old white men vote. Younger people, unfortunately, don't vote as much. And politicians follow that. Finally, politicians are obsessed with the mainstream media. Watch them going towards the Sunday talk shows like Lemmings. They are eager to be in the mainstream media. They pay much more attention to it than they do to social media or than they do to the alternative media. But it's in social media and it's in the alternative media the change is actually beginning. Finally, another really important indicator in this country is not what's happening in the Muslim community or the Jewish community. It's what's happening among Christians. And if you look at some of the mainstream Protestant churches, there is significant movement in the direction of justice in Palestine, significant movement in the direction of divestment. Two major Protestant churches, the Methodist Church and the Presbyterian Church, have made major significant moves in this direction. This is an indication of a grassroots change that's not yet visible at the political level. Now, it's not clear when public opinion will finally have an impact on the political level. I would guess that this won't happen very quickly. It will not happen very quickly. But I would point out to you that most people would have said the same thing about the political level, about mainstream politicians in England, Ireland, Spain, France, and Sweden 6 months ago. All of these countries have taken significant steps in the direction of the Palestinian position. The UK Parliament, the Irish Parliament, the Spanish Parliament, and the Swedish government have all taken a stand in favor of Palestinian rights. This is unprecedented. The French Parliament is about to do the same thing. These are the most important countries in Europe, except for Germany. And the fact that this change took place so quickly should be encouraging to us. It means that even though change may take a while in the United States, when it begins, it may happen very rapidly. Let me talk secondly about the mainstream media. Here, too, I do not think we can expect quick change. And the reasons are very simple. Corporate ownership. TV and media executives, producers, editors, who are these people? They're older and they're predominantly male. They're conservative and they're predominantly pro-Israel. As long as the ownership, the editors, the producers are in that group, you cannot expect the corporate mainstream media to change or change quickly. It will take a long time and it will be youth-oriented media that will change first and fastest. But let me make an important point. Most young people are not consumers of the mainstream media. Why did you have those numbers that Josh put up there for young people? It's because they don't believe the lies that the mainstream media has been selling for 50 and 60 and 70 years. Because they don't trust the mainstream media. They don't consume the mainstream media. Ask people 20 years old, how much CNN do you watch? None. How much MSNBC do you watch? None. Do you read the New York Times? Never. They don't look at that stuff. They get their information from a variety of sources in the alternate media. They get their information from social media. They get their information from YouTube. They get their information from sources in the Middle East. They are in a different planet where the media is concerned. And so even if the mainstream media does not change, the fact that there have been enormous changes in the alternative media, and that the cause of Palestine in the alternative media is much more advanced and there's much more understanding, means that there is going to be change, irrespective of how slowly the mainstream media changes. And you can see this on campuses. I speak at campuses all over the United States. I teach at a university in New York City, but I speak all over the country. And everywhere I go, I'm shocked and surprised and pleased by how well-informed young people are. If they were watching TV, they would be stupider. Because TV is jihaz tajhil innas. It makes them more ignorant. There are actually statistics that show the more television you watch, TV news you watch, the less you understand. Kids don't watch that. Kids have their own sources of information. And so on campuses, you have a level of alertness and awareness which their parents and grandparents simply don't have. Let me finally talk about changes in the Jewish community. From the outside, This community appears to be changing with glacial slowness, if it's changing at all. If you look at groups like the ADL, if you look at the Zionist Organization of America, if you look at the mainstream organizations in the Jewish community, they are as right-wing, as Zionist, as conservative as ever before. But if you look just below the surface, if you look in particular at the internal debate within the Jewish community, it is clear that the right-wing Zionist leadership is deeply worried about what is happening in their own, or the community they claim to represent. They're worried that they are losing liberals from Jewish congregations where right-wingers control synagogues and won't allow contrary views to be expressed. They're worried about assimilation as more and more Jews marry non-Jews. And most importantly, they're worried about the trends among Jewish youth. And they are right to worry about trends among the kids. While many Jewish young people are still conventional in their views, right-wing or liberal Zionist, increasingly the best and the brightest students on campus who identify themselves as Jewish are rebelling against a political orthodoxy that they know is false and that they know is misleading. And these are, I insist, these are not just a small group. They're a large and growing group. And they're not just any young people in the Jewish community. They are almost invariably the brightest among them. They are the most successful. They're ones who are going to the best universities, or they're the ones in any university, state universities, community colleges, who stand out because they're smarter, because they have an insight into what's going on in the world. These are the people that they are losing, and they understand that these are the kind of people that they're losing. So there's lots of evidence for this. I spoke at a conference for something called Open Hillel, which was held at Harvard University a month and a half ago. And this is groups that have broken away from the Hillel organizations on dozens of campuses across the United States because they refused to be censored and muzzled. They refused to be prevented from listening to Palestinian speakers. They refused to be prevented from being allowed to argue for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And these kids broke away from Hillel organizations. These are Jewish students on campuses all over the United States. And this is just one of many manifestations of this change among young people. So, if change is beginning in public opinion, if under the surface of politics something is beginning to happen, if the alternative media have opened new audiences to the Palestinian cause, and if there's ferment among the youth and on campuses and in the churches, when can we expect this shift to affect politics in this country? Now, I'm by training a historian. I don't predict the future. I don't know any more about the future than any of you do. If you ask me about the past, I can maybe tell you something. I don't know when this change is going to happen. But I think there are a few historical pointers that are helpful. If we study our own community, if we study how change takes place in this country in historical instances, we will see that, in fact, change may well be very soon on the way. Take the case of the Jewish community in this country. It took the Jewish community in this country two full generations from the time most of them immigrated in the period just before, during, and after World War I, two full generations until the 1940s and 50s, before they had any political influence in the United States. At a time of the greatest danger for Jews in the world, in the 1930s and 40s, when Hitler had come to power, when the Holocaust was being planned, the American Jewish community had absolutely no influence on American policy. They could not push the United States into war with Nazi Germany. They could not open the doors of the United States to the immigration of Jewish refugees. They had no influence. They had been here a generation and a half, and they essentially were powerless. Within a generation more, you can see the beginning of the building up of some ability to affect American policy. Until today, this is a community with extraordinary influence and capability to affect politics, as we know. This is characteristic of most immigrant communities. It will probably take Muslim Americans and Arab Americans less time than two or two and a half generations. We are a new community in this country. Most of you, most of the people in this room, if they emigrated, or if their parents emigrated, that was an emigration in the 60s or 70s or 80s. That wasn't an emigration in the 1920s or 30s or 40s. My mother came here in the 20s, but I'm an exception. My father came here in the 40s. I'm an exception. Most of you either came here in the 70s, 80s, or 90s, or your parents did. That means the first generation that was educated here, that knows perfect English, that understands the American system, that sees itself as full Americans. You may be Muslims, you may be Palestinians or Lebanese or whatever your ethnicity is, but you are Americans. The first generation is just now coming to maturity, is just now going to school, professional school, graduate school, going into business, beginning to establish themselves. It's not our parents' generation or your parents' generation, the people who emigrated to this country, my parents' generation emigrated to this country. It's the ones who were born here and their children who will have the kind of impact that African Americans or Jewish Americans or other communities began to have about a generation or two after they immigrated here. And it will not begin at the top. It will not begin with a president or a Senate majority or 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 members of the House or 12 governors. It will begin with city councilmen and women. It will begin with mayors. It will begin with state senators, state representatives, local school boards, and those will be the building blocks, eventually, of an impact for this community in the United States. And it'll take much less time than I think you realize. Your kids, if you have children old enough to be in college, your kids will do it. Or if you're in college, you will do it. Or if you've just finished school, you're beginning to do it. That's the generation that's going to do this, that's going to have an impact on politics. I think that we are going to see something else that's going to have a positive impact. And this is an increasing involvement of Arab Americans and Muslim Americans in the media. It'll start with the alternative media. The mainstream media will be very resistant. But it will have an enormous impact over time. The only perspective you get in the mainstream media, essentially, is a different perspective than ours. As Miko Pellet said in the panel before here, it's a reiteration of a false Israeli narrative. Our narrative is not in the mainstream media. When there are more and more people who look like us, like you, like our community looks, in the media, that will change. It has to change, and it will change. It'll start with the alternative media, but it'll soon continue with the mainstream media. And I want to say two more things, one about universities and one about scholarship. On many college campuses, I actually have some very good news for you. The Palestine cause is able to hold its own. You would not want to be advocating the positions that supporters of Israel advocate on many American college campuses today. They do not have a leg to stand on. There is no way they can argue a bankrupt case. They are failing. They are spending huge amounts of money. There are dozens, literally dozens of organizations sending people to Palestine, Taglit, Birthright Israel, bringing Israel advocacy specialists to come and be stationed in Hillels all over campuses. They're spending tons of money. They're working their fingers to the bone, and they are not succeeding. A few kids, Students for Justice in Palestine, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, Jewish Voice for Peace, small groups that have no money, no backing, limited organization, are holding their own on dozens and dozens and dozens of college campuses, reaching kids, affecting people, having an enormous impact on the next generation of college students. You would not believe the kinds of things I see going from campus to... I was in Lexington, Kentucky. I was in North Carolina State. I was at a small school in Pennsylvania in the last several months. Every campus, there is a branch of Students for Justice in Palestine. Every single campus I've been to. This did not happen 40 years ago, I promise you. And these are not just Muslim and Arab kids. These are Jewish kids. These are white American kids. These are other Latino kids, African American. These are a smorgasbord of students who've been awakened to the issue and who are fighting for the cause of justice in Palestine. It's something quite amazing to see. So that's the first thing I want to say to you. As these kids learn to build alliances, to work with other groups on campus, they're going to get stronger and stronger. Because it's not just a Palestinian cause. It's a cause involving justice. And things like Palestine and Ferguson. Things like indigenous peoples. We are an indigenous people being oppressed by a colonial regime. So were Native Americans. There are alliances that can be built along those lines. And some of these students are doing it. So that's the first thing I want to say. The second thing I want to say is that there has been an important shift in the world of academia, in the world of scholarship. When I began as an undergraduate, there were basically almost no books that reflected anything but a Zionist narrative. Today, it is very hard in respected scholarship to put forth the kind of meretricious, false arguments that used to be rampant in scholarship 40 or 50 years ago. There has been a sea change in the academy in the last 30 years or so. 30 or 40 years, most academics ignored Palestine. 30 or 40 years, most academics were biased against the Palestine cause or they kept their mouths shut. Today, just the other day, in Washington, D.C., the Middle East Studies Association passed the first step towards advocating boycott, divestment, and sanctions. That is the leading organization of American academics. The Asian Studies Association, the American Studies Association have passed similar resolutions. These are mainstream academic organizations that represent tens of thousands of professors, and they are moving towards the side of justice. They are moving towards supporting the Palestinian cause. And for them, it's not our cause. It's because it's a just cause. As somebody said, Angela Davis said the other day, the cause of Palestine is the Vietnam of the 21st century. It's the South Africa of the 21st century. And academics are responding to that. And the scholarship reflects that. It's not just their activism. It's the books that are being written. It's the courses that are being taught. It's the young people who are being whose minds are being opened to a narrative that challenges an Israeli narrative that is largely false. So, what more is needed? First, we need more activism, but we need intelligent activism that is directed against the American public. What we do not need is a kind of narcissistic, self-reflecting activism where we talk to ourselves. We can talk to ourselves, we need to talk to ourselves, but we need to talk to them, to the Americans. We don't want to change ourselves. We have to change ourselves, of course. But we also need to change them. That means that those in this community who speak perfect English, every person under 20 in this room, or 30, or whatever the age is, those people who have gone to American schools, understand how the Constitution works, those people have that responsibility to speak outside of this community to the broader American community with their activism. The second thing we need is more scholarship. I turn down 30 or 40 speaking requests every couple of months. Why do I do that? Because I speak once a week already, and I can't do any more. I have what we call a day job that pays my salary. I have to teach. I have to take care of my students. I can't speak 4 days a week. We need dozens of people, credentialed, respected, tenured academics who can go out and speak, not the way I'm talking to you, to our own community, who can talk about the facts, who can lay out this reality that is ignored by many Americans in a measured, objective, intelligent manner. What does that mean? That means more of your children, or more of you if you're young people, have to resist the lure of money and work in fields that are not terribly remunerative, like academia. Okay, I want more people to be doctors. I want more people to be lawyers. I want more accountants. I want more businessmen. I want more engineers. That's where you'll make money. But one of your brothers or one of your sisters can do a PhD in social sciences or humanities and become a professor and go on the road so they don't have to turn down 40 invitations every 2 months. Okay? We need more of this. We need more people who are credentialed, tenured academics who understand what is actually happening in Palestine because we've lived it, okay? And who can put forward this not as activists, as scholars. in an objective fashion, our cause is not just just, it represents essentially a truth. Their cause is not just unjust, it in enormously important measure, it represents an untruth. All you have to do is get the truth out there. That's not an easy thing to do. But that needs not just activism, not just the political level, not just the media. Those are all vital. It needs people who are going to speak to ordinary audiences and just talking to them about the realities out there. We have to finally continue pushing hard on all of these levels I've talked about, but we have to have patience. I have 2 minutes. So you have to have patience too. We have to have patience because this may take time. Everybody wants it to happen quickly. I hope it happens quickly. But if it doesn't happen quickly, it means we have to be planning. Where do we want to be in 4 years, 5 years, 6 years? It will only happen when we have laid the foundations, done the preparatory work, and when people are ready. Think of any great change in history. If the people aren't ready, it didn't happen. You can think about any revolution. You can think about the prophet. You can think about any historical situation you want. If the groundwork hasn't been laid, if the preparation hasn't been done, if people are not ready, it's not going to happen. So before it happens, we have to do all of this. Not just us, other people who believe in the importance of justice in Palestine. I think what's happening in Europe should really encourage us. Change is happening. It seems like when we look at the tragic situation in Gaza, it's not happening fast enough. Of course it isn't. But it is happening. And it will be resisted most fiercely in the United States. Because if things change here, nothing can stay the same there. Without the support of the United States, Israel is in a very different position. They will fight back, but they are already losing. We have to keep pushing. Thank you very much.
That was Rashi Khalidi, professor of history at Columbia University. And that is all the time we have this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live at www.wzbc.org. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.